Sorry, guys, there's no show opening built in today, so Lydia's just going to do one for you. Danny and Gallant, live from spring training.
That's the best one we've ever had. The sun is up down here in Arizona. The Mariners are out. We're seeing some stretching done. Looks like the pitchers are working out some kinks in their neck. We have some infield practice going on. I saw Julio Rodriguez taking a bat into the batting cage. He's a little bigger than I expected, Paul.
Yeah, a little taller.
Yeah, looked like a powerhouse going in there, the 19-year-old outfielder. We are here at spring training for the next week. We're going to have Jerry DePoto with us today at 8:20, so in the second hour of the show, which we're really looking forward to. And the season has started. They've begun the first Cactus League game, and I think some pretty encouraging signs. More than anything, this is a year where we're going to get a clearer vision of the Mariners' future. Last year, we knew which direction we're headed. This year, we're going to actually start to see it. And some of the players that they're hoping are going to be ready to contribute.
And this is our opportunity to see these guys that basically have nothing more than a number next to them in those baseball prospectus rankings. Because you don't really get to see those guys on a regular basis unless you're someone who's crazy and can find out all these online streams of minor league baseball games. And that's what I'm most excited about, Danny. I want to know that these guys have something special. And that's what's going to be great over the next couple of days. We're going to get to see that firsthand. And specifically with Kelenic and with Julio Rodriguez.
Last year, we knew that the Mariners had made a change in direction, that they had decided not so much to rebuild as to sort of retool themselves for the future. They weren't trying to maximize their chances of making the playoffs in 2019. They were looking ahead to 2021, 2022. And that resulted in a little bit of a disconnect where you had a lot of players who were going to make the major league roster that knew they were maybe not part of the long-term plan here. This year, we're starting to see the players that they do believe will help turn this franchise around who are going to be having everyday roles. Evan White, we're going to talk to as a first baseman, someone who this team has signed to a six-year contract before he's got ahead of even Double A. Jared Kelenic and Julio Rodriguez, who are kind of the two top prospects. But it's other guys. Yusei Kikuchi pitched yesterday. And for anybody that was watching, the result of the Cactus League game, entirely unimportant. The fact that Yusei Kikuchi sat at 94 miles an hour and touched 95 is a hugely important thing because last year he was someone who, I don't want to say, it wasn't what we expected. We expected more from him last year, and I would say that the same was probably true for Justice Sheffield, the prospect they got from the Yankees. The Mariners are going to need to find the arms for their pitching staff, and I thought Yusei's start yesterday was a very good step in that direction.
Well, Jerry DePoto, who we're going to talk to in the next hour, he said last week that they have a chance, this Mariners team, to have a really deep pitching staff, and it's easy to be skeptical about that at first when you see it because you want to actually see it firsthand, and you're talking about in Kikuchi, a guy who's completely reworked his mechanics, Justice Sheffield as well. So that's also something that we're going to be able to see. That is the most interesting part about this, because right now it's basically, you know Marco Gonzalez, you know what he's going to bring to the table, and this Mariners gave him the long contract like they did for Evan White, because clearly they're telling him, hey, look, you're here for the long haul, you got to get all these young kids, essentially, to be on the same level as you so that eventually this actually can turn around. But yeah, for the pitchers, it's going to be big. It was good to see that Kikuchi was getting some, like, consistent velocity up in the 95 area, but there's still stuff to work on for him. And, you know, if you look at the box score, it was not the most pretty day at the park, but people are impressed by the progress that he showed day one.
You're also, and this is always going to happen, your pitchers are going to have more temperamental results.
Yes.
In spring.
It's only two innings usually.
It's a shorter appearance. It's also, there'll be a lot of talk about the dry air and your ball won't move as much. Balls tend to rocket out of the park. I think that Kikuchi, his ability to hit corners is going to stay and to work at the corners of the plate. The velocity was something that I was surprised was not there last year, because that was, he came with a reputation for being able to throw harder than what we saw. And seeing him get back to it, and I'd read the story by Ryan Divish that basically a couple weeks after the season ended, Yusei Kikuchi went to Driveline, which is one of the sort of baseball factories, the guys where they work on mechanics.
Yeah, it's Trevor Bauer's favorite place.
Yeah, it is. Trevor Bauer's a huge advocate of Driveline. And we're focused on his mechanics. To see him having that velocity is something that's really important. There's also just an excitement, man, of getting down here and seeing the team rolling out. And you do get a sense that this is a group, as opposed to last year where you had a division between guys who were here for the short term. We're now seeing more of the guys that the Mariners plan on being here for the long term.
And that's big. And, you know, it's a sacrifice for those guys. I mean, you know that this year is not the year. DePoto said last week that it's about the process first, worry about the scoreboard later. That's got to be tough. I mean, if you are someone who wants to get back to winning ways, I mean, these seasons are very long, and I can imagine when you do have a bunch of young guys on the roster who are figuring things out, but you know how to be a professional, and you're watching them essentially grow up before your eyes, some of them figuring it out, some of them never figuring it out. It's got to be tough. So for those veterans, this is an important time, I think, to leave their mark and to show all these other guys, all right, this is how it goes. Now, we're starting off right now, obviously, the spring training, but once things get serious, I'm very curious as to what kind of an impact they'll have on those young players.
You also have a chance for them to build sort of the unity and camaraderie, and that's something we don't talk about as much in baseball. Baseball is, in my mind, the most individual of all the team sports, but that's not true inside the clubhouse. In the mechanics of the day-to-day logistics of a game, it is. You have your individual at-bats, and it's a one-on-one matchup between you and the pitcher, and you have your assignment. The shortstop never decides that he's not going to throw the ball to the first baseman because they don't like each other. Like, that happens in basketball. It does not happen in baseball. But there is also that building of a culture.
Yeah.
And that's something that has been very important to the Mariners, and one of the reasons that they're trying to move groups of players through the minor leagues together, believing that that's the best way to build that.
I've witnessed a turnaround. That is what the Mariners are trying to accomplish. Now, obviously, there was some trash can banging at the very end of said turnaround that made things maybe skyrocket a little bit more than you would expect. But at first for that Astros team in 2013 and 2014, I mean, this was a team that was basically a lost cause. They had no idea where they were going. It was basically at a point where you're hoping for a lot of young minor league players to eventually come up. And I will give A.J. Hinch a lot of credit for this, because obviously it has not been the best last couple of months for him or anyone in that organization. But he was able to eventually bring the cultural gap in the clubhouse together, because there's usually a difference between guys who don't speak English primarily and those who are speaking English. They eventually molded together, and that clubhouse had a really great feel to it eventually, especially when they finally won the World Series. Carlos Beltran gets a lot of credit for that, also for trash cans. Whatever, that's the side. It takes time to build something like that, but we are starting to see the beginning of that.
What's wrong with the Astros?
What's not wrong with the Astros?
Look, why are you taking signs away from fans?
I thought this was America.
Training? No. It's not even that. That is like the dumbest thing you could do. Like, why are you trying to squelch? If anything, you should try and let everybody get it out of their system right now. Anybody that missed it, over the weekend, the Houston Astros played their first Grapefruit League game. They're in Florida. They're not over here in Arizona. We're not going to see them. But at their first game, they were technically the road team playing against the Nationals, a rematch of the World Series game. They share the facility, and somebody had like a piece of poster board that had drawn on it with a marker, Houston, and then an asterisk,
and then an
apostrophe S, like the Houston asterisks. That's fairly clever, among all the things. It's certainly not profane, and they take the sign away, which then becomes a story about them stealing the sign, which is the most biggest layup joke that you could possibly make.
It really was.
They don't play any of their regular players, not one of them. And send them out. So they send out a bunch of minor league kids to get booed. What's the mascot? Orbit? Orbit gets booed. Anybody associated with the Astros gets booed. What genius came up with this PR strategy? Because it's exceptionally dumb.
Is this how everyone felt about the Soviets back during the 1980s and 1990s?
No, because we were at least scared of the Soviets. Like, there was enough Cold War propaganda that we were worried about, like, whether they were going to nuke us or not. Like, what are the Astros going to do?
True.
Come out here and wail on a trash can 50 times? We'll show you. You won't stop our trash can banging.
I mean, they are taking away, though, free speech. I mean, every American is entitled, I thought, to bring in a sign. If they weren't profane signs, that's what I don't get.
There's a rule against signs, and so I can understand. You don't enforce that rule this day. Like, you let everyone boo you because everybody, they're going to boo at some point, and you want them to get that out of their system. And it's better for them to get it out of their system early as possible.
Yes.
Instead, it's like the Astros are like, we don't really want to be the target of animosity.
Hand out poster board. Give out markers. That should be your giveaway.
Seriously, like, you should lean into the joke. Like, that's the only way you're going to come out of it
but
at this point.
They don't know how to, and they are still in denial. I feel so bad for that poor, definitely underpaid, because that's what the Astros do. They underpay the people that aren't on the high end of the operations, knowing from experience from people I know who I was friends with. That poor person, imagine you're the person that goes viral for a clip, and you're taking these signs away as well. You don't want to do this. And you know, deep down inside, this is not going to make it look any better. This is essentially the Streisand effect. Let's continue to make this all the center of attention. And you're right.
I'm not familiar with the Streisand effect.
Oh, you haven't heard about this?
No.
Okay, so basically Barbara Streisand, which she got a mansion. She was trying to keep this mansion essentially private entirely. Someone, I guess, revealed the location and the picture of the mansion online, and she sued them. And in suing them, she actually called more attention to the location of said mansion, so now everyone knew where it was. She wanted it to be completely invisible to the eye. So basically, by trying to hide it from getting attention, she created more attention for it.
Is that irony? Like having the exact opposite effect of what you intended.
So if they made like insult us night at the ballpark, come on down to Tropicana Field, throw trash on the field.
Hand out the trash cans as your promo.
Yes. Like, wouldn't we collectively kind of respect
them?
I'd laugh.
Yeah, wouldn't it make something off limits? People just want to do it more. So
completely.
If you allow them to do it.
Yes, that's exactly what it is.
Isn't it so much fun that they're this dumb?
Yes,
it is enjoyable.
It's making me so happy.
It's Danny and Gallant. It's now time for What to Watch For.
What to Watch For, every morning at 7:10. Brought to you by Dublin Law Group. The first look at the stories worth watching today with Danny and Gallant.
So the Astros took away some signs. That was actually our first planned element. For what to watch for. The Astros sort of revealing themselves to be dunces. Yeah, they've just made a whole bunch of people decide they want to smuggle into Grapefruit League games.
I'm nervous now. I'm nervous that if signs are not allowed to be brought into Grapefruit League games, are we going to be allowed to bring in trash cans to T-Mobile Park this season when the Astros come to town? Are we going to be prevented? Are we going to be given our God-given American right to wear a trash can helmet like I'm going to do and cut out holes for the eyes and for the mouth?
Wait, what if the Mariners did what Lydia suggested instead of the Astros?
Well, they should.
I mean,
we'll start the movement right
now. They've got a really good marketing department.
Okay.
I trust them.
That's a good one.
Hint, hint. We're like 10 feet away from the marketing department right now.
Make this t-shirt.
Hey, guys!
Here is the other thing, is that the Astros probably violated a rule for spring training.
Classic.
By not having any regulars play. Because there's a rule, as a visiting team in spring training, you're required to play four guys who were considered regulars the previous season or are considered to have a chance to be regulars in the upcoming season. And the idea is you don't want fans coming to a park and not getting a chance to see, like, hey, we want to see the Giants take on the Mariners, and then all of a sudden you don't have any of the signature players that are there. So by not having any major leaguers,
outlaws.
All minor leaguers.
They're the outlaw brand, man. You got to rep it. You got to rep that outlaw brand. You got to swagger around like it, because right now you're the big old bad boys of baseball.
What to watch for.
The NFL Combine is underway in Indianapolis, and you know what that means. It's time for quarterback hand sizes. You ready for this one? Tua Tagovailoa, 10-inch hands. Joe Burrow, 9-inch hands. Jake Fromm, 8 7/8-inch hands. Bust!
It's just creepy.
I honestly would say I would not draft Jake Fromm, but it doesn't have much to do with his hand size. What about Eason? What are his mitts measuring?
9 4/8.
Oh, that's pretty good.
Why 4/8? Why not a half?
You guys really doing your like best Brock Huard impression right now.
Those calves, those hips.
Huard Body Show.
You know what they say about big hands? Large gloves.
Ha. Sometimes large shoes.
What to watch for.
Nice.
The Washington Huskies have a positive point differential in Pac-12 play. Yes, the Washington Huskies men's basketball team that's 3-13 has a positive point differential because they waxed Cal by 35 points.
Danny's still trying to make the Washington Husky basketball team happen. No one cares.
It's probably true.
That
it's
doesn't
amazing.
Make any sense, though.
I want to throw that in the face of everyone who kept pointing at the Seahawks point differential. Like, they're not very good because their point differential. Yeah, point differential might not mean anything. If that Washington team, which is awful, has a positive point differential, and they've won 3 Pac-12 games, and they've got a positive point differential in Pac-12 games, I think the problem is point differential as a significant metric.
It's like time of possession.
Yeah, yes.
Where you're like, maybe, sometimes it means something.
Right.
Okay.
But if you can score in less than 2 minutes and your opponent is just going to chew up a bunch of clock and do nothing. But, you know.
I saw something in the Seattle Times. It was a headline, and it said, I think, essentially, this was online. Maybe they changed it. And whoever writes the headlines, listen, I know it's a tough job. But someone wrote, can the Huskies still turn it around? I really wish that that link, if I clicked on it, would just say, N-O, period. The whole post.
Paul's got a future as a content creator with that. It's time for the morning drive with John Clayton. We're going to bring him in and see if we can find out what the heck's going on with the collective bargaining agreement.
John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
It's a four-way battle, and there's only going to be three spots. Somebody has to go.
The first and final word on everything NFL from the professor, John Clayton.
Presented by DivorceLawyersForMen.com.
They scored 30 points a game. They're the best running team in football.
It's John Clayton's Morning Drive with Danny and Gallant.
Professor, what's going on?
Hey, just getting ready to fly out to Indianapolis after the show today.
You're going to head out there for the scouting combine. I know that the CBA is going to be a huge point of discussion. Last story I read is that the players, the player representatives are split on whether or not to accept the deal that's on the table.
Yeah, and of course, I mean, remember, the union has already accepted the deal. That's the weird part about it. I mean, even though it was the executive committee voted 6-5 against accepting it, this was accepted by Demoris Smith and the people who negotiated, and now it's a matter of trying to sell it to the players. And so the idea is that they have the 32 reps are going to be coming in tomorrow to talk more about it. They're going to have a meeting with the owners to see if there's any way to get a few more things in the bargaining agreement that maybe they can help sell it. But ultimately, it's coming down to a vote on Wednesday. Now, remember, if it's going to be a vote of the player reps, they're probably going to say no. It's already been a vote of the, and again, they have to have two-thirds of those, and it's already been a vote of the 11-man executive committee, and they've said no. But the problem is now it goes to the players, and it's a 50-50 thing where if more than 50% of the players can do it. And of course, remember, you have more than half the league that's in their rookie contracts, either as undrafted guys or free agents, undrafted free agents and draft choices, and they may decide, you know what, 25% increase in base salary, less work in the off season, less work in training camp, more perks, all those things. They may say yes, but right now they don't know if they have the votes.
John, I'm a dumb head, so just simplify this for me. What's going to happen? Is it going to be voted on, or is this going to be denied?
It's going to be voted on, but because they're going to do it by conference call, and if it's shot down, then expect a strike next year. Expect a lockout, whatever it's going to be. There's going to be labor problems, and so that's why Demoris is trying to buy as much time as possible. You know, he now has until Thursday to see if he can have the vote, because what they did is move the franchise and transition tags back from Tuesday to Thursday, and if they don't get a vote, and if they don't, again, the vote is planned to be on Wednesday, but right now you can't tell one way or another if he has the votes or not.
The logistics, you mentioned the franchise tag and transition tag. That's been delayed 2 days. Usually those would be set tomorrow. Now they're going to be set on Thursday. There's no expectation Seattle will use its franchise tag on anybody.
No, not at all. They can't do it on Clowney because they've already made that agreement between the two that they will not franchise him. Jaron Reed, he's not going to be $15 million on a franchise tag. Now, one thing they can do, but I still don't think they can, if there is no collective bargaining agreement, then you have the ability to transition. But really, the transition numbers this year aren't that much less than the franchise numbers. And, of course, with the transition, if you end up losing the player, then what happens is that you're not going to get the compensatory pick. So I don't anticipate anybody being franchised on this team.
The Ravens are expected to franchise tag Matthew Judon. Do you think that he will end up getting a long-term contract with Baltimore, or are they doing that potentially so that they still have him under contract and can trade him?
Yeah, I think that's the new trend, and I think that's going to be not just Judon, but I think it's going to be several other teams doing the same things with edge rushers. But their thinking is they end up losing two pass rushers. They lost Terrell Suggs, and then they end up losing Za'Darius Smith, and Za'Darius ended up going to Green Bay, and so you get a third-round compensatory for that loss. But I think what the idea is, if you can't get the deal done and you know you're not going to be able to get a deal, try to make that trade as other teams did, including Seattle, so you can get a second-round pick, a first-round pick, or maybe more, as opposed to waiting for a compensatory pick the next year.
John, tell me the Bengals are not going to franchise tag A.J. Green.
They're going to franchise tag A.J. Green.
Oh, John, I told you to tell me they're not going to.
Well, I can't lie. I mean, they're not going to lose A.J. Green.
Yeah, and that's a bummer because that's the one guy I'd like. The trouble with the Bengals is the Bengals are not a rational organization. So as we're talking about are the Ravens maybe just going to franchise tag him to trade him, I'm almost certain if the Bengals franchise tag A.J. Green, they're not going to trade him.
They're not going to trade him,
they
no.
Don't, yeah.
They're a team that doesn't make trades. I mean, for the most part. I mean, they'll make a couple, but they're not really big in trading. I mean, they're big in homegrown guys, and A.J. Green's a homegrown guy. They want to get him to a long-term contract, but they realize that they probably can't, and he'll probably hold out. You can anticipate that, but no, I think they're going to franchise him. And again, you know, when you think about that, do you really want to pay $18 million to A.J. Green? As a 31, 32-year-old wide receiver, that'd be a bad move for this team.
Coaches apparently want a sky judge. I think everyone that watches the NFL would like a sky judge, John. But apparently the league office and league officials are skeptical that it's viable. And to that I say, what? How does that make sense?
Doesn't make any sense at all. I mean, you look at it. I mean, you saw it in the AAF. You saw it in the XFL. That looks good. I mean, you know, you have somebody there who can work with the officials. He's at the game. You know, he's in the city. There's good communication and all that stuff. I don't understand why the owners aren't for that. I mean, coaches wanted it last year. But, you know, in a lot of ways, coaches were their own enemy last year because at the owners' meeting, you know, the coaches were looking for the challenge that they could have on the post pass interference, and you know they end up getting it. Then at the end they didn't want it. Well, now it's like, okay, you can't have it both ways. But no, sky judge to me is the right answer. And so the competition committee started their meetings in Indy over the weekend, and you know, you get the push by the coaches, but right now you get the push back from the league.
How does the sky judge work?
Sky judge basically is the eighth official. And that's the thing I don't understand. It's like, you know, they're talking about the economics of it, and the owners have to see they can do it. But he's the eighth official, and, you know, he's probably somebody who's been an official in the league. He's worked with the referees and all those different guys in some capacity. But, you know, he sits up in the press box. I mean, again, he's the replay official at the game, but he's given more power and more ability to communicate with the referee. To me, it just makes sense.
Yeah, it does. I like the idea of the sky judge. I'm interested in how it would work in practice. Does he watch replays as well?
No, a sky judge just sits up there, and you can see it in the XFL games where you know, he'll sit there, he'll communicate with the referee, and they'll both come up with a decision. But you know, he has a little bit more clout because he has more ability to take a look at the replays and make some decisions.
Interesting.
A pet peeve of mine is when people Bill Polian and they act like they were going to draft somebody in a certain draft and they didn't actually do it. But we got that from Jim Irsay yesterday. Jim Irsay said the Colts would have taken Russell Wilson in round 4 of the 2012 NFL draft. John, when you hear an owner say something like that, what's the first thing that jumps to your mind?
Well, I mean, you saw the first thing, like that one jumps to my mind is that, you know, when RG3 was taken by Washington and they came back in the fourth round and took Kirk Cousins. But to me, you know, it's like, okay, it's nice to hear that. But again, it's like, you know, it didn't happen. So it's like it's history that doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, he also would not have gotten to the fourth round because about 5 other teams have said they were going to take him in the third round.
Right, the Jets were one of those teams, yeah.
Yeah, and the Eagles, they were going to do it. It's amazing how that happens, where, like, we were really close to being able
we
to
almost
pull the,
did it, man.
We were going to pull the trigger.
It's like talking about your fantasy team.
What are the Colts going to what are the Colts going to do at quarterback? They've still got Brisket, but they've got to be looking either to draft somebody or
no, I think they're going to take Philip Rivers.
Sign a free agent.
No, I think Philip Rivers seems to be the candidate that they're looking at. Now, you notice that when Jim Irsay talked yesterday, he didn't rule out any possibilities. He said, you know, right now, Jacoby Brissett is the quarterback, but that's for right now.
I'd love to see Cam Newton there. Is that a realistic possibility?
No.
Where do you think he's going to end up?
I don't know. A good question. I don't think he's going to end up in Carolina, but I don't know what team he's going to end up going for. You know, they're going to obviously try to trade him, but figuring out where he goes next is pretty impossible at the moment.
All right, Professor, we need you to travel safe after your show. Get to Indy. The Circle City? Is that the nickname for Indianapolis? I think it is. And then we will be talking to you there tomorrow, and maybe we'll talk to you about hand size.
There you go.
Quarterback hand size. Professor, thank you so much.
Thanks.
That is the Professor, John Clayton. Houston continues to have a problem with managing the blowback. Also, potentially some ideas about how to fix baseball. That's all ahead. Danny and Gallant live from spring training.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant,
powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios
on 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
And we are live from Mariners Spring Training in Peoria, Arizona. It is a beautiful, beautiful morning on Danny and Gallant. Paul Gallant, Danny O'Neill, Jessamyn McIntyre hanging out. The Houston Astros are not doing themselves any favors. It is.
Thank you, Houston Astros, for doing us favors.
Jess, is this story ever going to go away? And I, you know what? I actually am happy it won't, because this has been something that every single day, it's like they're giving us a layup. And the most recent layup that they have given us is they have decided to basically turn the ballpark into an un-American place. They have decided to take away fans and their ability to protest what has been wrong with the game. Yesterday, some people that were bringing out Houston asterisks S signs, those signs were confiscated from them, Danny, and they were not allowed to use it, and now we continue to talk about them.
It's a bad idea to curb people's ability to boo them, because people are going to boo them. Houston is taking a very misguided approach that if we just control what people are able to say, they won't say bad stuff. And that's actually not at all what happens.
In Soviet Houston, sign make you. Like, I don't know what you're supposed to say here at this point if you're the Astros, but this is definitely not it.
It's not. And that's part of the problem. It's not just what they did, but what they've, how they've responded to it that's made it worse. Let's go back and look at, we knew about the trash can banging about a month ago.
Yeah.
Like, that was when the report came out, right? And Hinch got fired and Luna got fired after they were each suspended for a year. And then we didn't have anything that there wasn't the same call for, like, vacate the World Series. Like, we knew all of this stuff happened a month ago. And then the Astros came out and had the, what I would characterize as the non-apology apology, where Jim Crane's kind of a doofus and he says, we don't think it affected the game. We won the World Series. Let's leave it at that. And then people got outraged. Now, maybe it's possible that it was because the football season was done, and so they had the full attention of the sporting universe trained on them. Or maybe it was because people looked at it and they're like, these jerks aren't sorry. Like, at least they could have the decency to come out and really feel bad about it. And they don't even feel bad. Now we should do something to them to make them feel bad. And at every turn, it seems that it's not just what Houston did that's making people upset. It's Houston's response to the anger over what they did that's making people mad. And that's pretty much the exact opposite of what you hire, like, image consultants and PR crisis managers for, is how do you get past this? How do you get, when people are mad at you, how do you allow them to get over their anger and forgive you? And it seems like that the Astros have basically seen everything about that and done the exact opposite, which is, don't really apologize. Don't show them how bad you feel. Like, don't make any sort of act of contrition or other Catholic-like exhibitions of guilt to engender sympathy. Don't, under any circumstances, allow people to boo you, because that would just make you feel bad. And you just want everybody to get over it, because this happened a long time ago, and eventually you've got to turn the page. Like, you need to, it's kind of your obligation when you screw up, is like, You have to sit there and take it for a little while.
You have to sit there and take it, but you also can't be out of touch. In 1789, Marie Antoinette famously said, "Let them eat cake," when she was asked about the people of Paris and how they did not have anything to eat. She said she was told they didn't have any bread. She's totally out of touch, and she actually says this in a refreshingly endearing manner. Well, how about they have cake? Like, she was apparently saying it in that manner. But everyone latches onto this, and they lost their minds, and obviously they all get guillotined and such. They're in the same kind of boat.
It's an interesting way of saying they lost their minds, by being guillotined and such.
Oh, well, I mean more the people of France and all that, and the French Revolution. But you get what I'm saying here.
You guys are on point today.
They're so tone deaf. And again, there's no way to like positively spin this. And you know, we joke about like having these nights where people can come and like heckle them. They're never going to do that. That would be a bad look for the people that are fans of the team. You wouldn't want that to happen in your own ballpark. But that's the only way they can really get around something like this. They have to just sit there and take it and not say anything. It's not that hard. It really isn't. For anything, it's just going to take patience. And guess what? People are always going to bring this up. That's the worst part about it. The only thing that you can do to shut everybody up is to have a successful season this coming year, and maybe, just maybe, some people zip it. Guess what? They're not going to, because they're going to accuse you of cheating again. That's just how it works.
You're going to have to sit there and take it.
Yeah.
Marv Albert had a very famous scandal, and it was all over the tabloids. And what was the point where you think that Marv Albert was actually – like able to come back? Because I would argue that it was when he sat down with David Letterman and Letterman skewered him for a solid 10 minutes. And it was ruthless. And I've heard that Marv Albert was very angry about it. Felt that Dave Letterman was one of Letterman's jokes was, Marv, I know you. And I made a vow when this thing started that I wasn't going to make any jokes about you. And he goes, and for 4 months, I've been like a farmer that left my crops out to rot. Because he asked him about hair plugs. I mean, just went through the entire thing. And Albert was really uncomfortable. But after that, I think people in large part moved past it with Marv Albert. And I guess the difference is that what the Astros did is tied to the game. It wasn't something in their personal lives. Like it was something tied to the sport that they play. But part of it is people kind of have to watch you suffer
yes,
a little bit.
Exactly.
Right? And I don't know if that's a good or a bad trait that we have, but you've got to suffer from it, and then you can come back. But you can't skip the suffering. Like, you can't just be
exactly.
Like, sorry, we all good now? Like, we wish we wouldn't have done that. We feel, earnestly, we feel bad. Can we talk about something else?
It's like going through a breakup, the guy moves on immediately, and you're like, dude, you're supposed to cry for a week.
You are supposed to go home and listen to You Want It Painted Black by the Rolling Stones while writing poetry in black marker on a black piece of paper.
Oh, wow.
Like, that's, you have to have a dark night of the soul. And if we don't see you go through the dark night of the soul, then we kind of wonder if you've really suffered enough.
And it shows that we're really not that far from where we were in the 1780s. I mean, shoot. Someone...
I think we're a little
to,
farther.
Back to beheading people.
Oh, well,
Galant's taking
one.
Us back to
Listen,
chopping people's
I'm
heads
sorry,
off.
I'm sorry that I'm just dropping some history bombs on you, but someone texted
you
in.
You
this
read
made
a lot
me laugh.
On the plane yesterday? What happened?
No, I
didn't. Watched Jojo Rabbit.
I watched Jojo Rabbit.
He also has Jess, do you think Paul travels with a neck pillow?
Yes. Yeah. 1,000%.
Do you travel with a neck pillow, Jess?
No.
Yeah.
I've
neither.
Been on 9 planes in the past 2 weeks.
Yeah, guess what? If you had a neck pillow, guess what? You'd be rested, refreshed, and ready to drop history references like some texter who said, how about they tar and feather Jose Altuve?
The other part is I didn't think it was possible to be softer than having a neck pillow and traveling with a makeshift cervical brace until Paul told me that his has a hot side and a cold side.
It does. Yeah, there's a cool side. There's a cool side. It's like the cool side of the pillow.
You actually have a cool side of the pillow on your neck pillow.
Yeah, it's like $20. It was $20.
Wow.
It was the bargain. The bargain was great. It's like I saw this in like Sky magazine, and I went home and I ordered it on Amazon as soon as I saw it.
We now know the cost of Paul's pride, $20.
See, but here's the thing. Like, I don't understand how this is shameful, but I don't care at all. I'm comfortable on the plane, and you're miserable.
I did it once, but it was on a trip to France, so I think I was justified in that point.
What, 2.5 hours? 2.5 hours? Is it justified?
No.
Oh, you
people. If they don't serve a hot meal on that flight, no neck pillow.
They don't serve hot meals on any flight.
Yeah, they don't serve anything.
If it's over 5 hours, they do, right?
Sometimes.
Alaska Airlines does. Alaska Airlines
Obviously.
Is our sponsor.
Oh, hey, I flew Alaska Airlines. It was a fantastic ride.
For spring training. We're really grateful to them. We're going to be down here all week. Talk a little Mariners baseball next.
Sounds good.
Who are the guys that we're most excited to see? Who's the player that's opened the most eyes so far? We'll tell you about Yusei Kikuchi's glove-popping debut next.
You're listening to Danny and Gallant.
Powered through the Alaska Airlines Studios.
On 710 ESPN Seattle.
Now, here are your hosts, Danny O'Neill and Paul Gallant.
It is Danny and Gallant, spring training in Peoria. And the Mariners will have their second Cactus League game today. We're talking about pitch counts and the idea of what is arbitrary and how you monitor that. Yusei Kikuchi was coming from Japan, where they have an entirely different throwing regimen. Those guys generally pitch once a week, but they throw way more often and stay in games much, much longer. And I think what was most alarming about Kikuchi is that the tendency has been when the Japanese pitchers come here, they experience mammoth success right off the bat. They generally tend to be at their best when they're just getting into the league and just being seen for the first time. And then we do see some tendencies and difficulties with arm trouble later on. I thought it was a great approach that they had about monitoring his innings. I would agree with you, and especially on pitchers in their prime, there's nothing that says a guy can't throw 130 pitches and come back and be effective. Everybody's different.
Yeah.
But there are also guys that are ruined by having those sort of Iron Man examples held out to them. And I'll be interested to see, Dusty Baker's notorious for this, of running extremely high inning counts on his pitchers and pitch counts on his pitchers. There shouldn't be an arbitrary cutoff because there are guys who are able to handle that workload, but there are other guys who, when they're said, well, he can do it, so why can't you? Which tends to be the way it goes in baseball, right? There's this sort of unspoken toughness, like, hey, we all pitch seven innings here as starters. There are guys that are ruined by that. There are guys whose arms are fundamentally altered. We know more about the arm than ever before. We still don't have any sort of magic bullet of how do you prevent arm injuries. And right now it's primarily elbow injuries as opposed to shoulder.
And also, I understand why they do it, because even when you do have one of these guys going out there, they might be tough and they might be gutting through a seven-inning performance, but they also might be just slowly razor-blading their shoulder into small little bits and turning it into just an absolute mess that won't be good in 10 years down the road. So obviously you want to keep an eye on what's going on long-term, but my big question is always about, like, why have we gotten to this point in a lot of things baseball-wise? Because it does feel like over my lifetime, it has dramatically changed.
Yes.
Like, you don't see pitchers go usually past six innings anymore.
You're right.
Sometimes you'll see guys get taken out. I mean, how many no-hitters were guys taken out of last season? My God, let the guy finish the no-hitter. I think it was four over the course of the regular season. It might have been more than that. It's ridiculous.
You're seeing there's two reasons for that. One is the fear of arm injuries, which has become such a boogeyman that people have decided to cut back on pitches, saying that's the best way to preserve it. And we don't know if that's really the case. We don't know if that's really does it prevent arm injuries? I don't know if it's
you
any
think
better.
It does.
Well, but it certainly prevents some guys who would be capable of pitching more innings without harm to their arms. It prevents them from doing that because now we're like, everybody scale back. And does it actually keep guys' arms healthier? I'm not sure about that. The other part is the shift in the emphasis on velocity out of the bullpen. You now just bring in flamethrowers. Like that's and you line them up, and we'll hear it when Jerry DePoto joins us at 8:20. They've talked about that the third time through the order generally is where pitchers, and you see the opposing batting average, all of the runners on base, guys tend to be better against a starter. That's why the opener's there.
Right.
The reason for the opener is to get you through the toughest part of the order the first time through, and then maybe that allows the starter or the main event or however they term the guy who's going to pitch most of the innings that game, that he can go into the sixth because he's not facing that top of the order three or maybe four times.
Conceptually, I do wonder going forward if this is something that's going to keep on happening that way. And that's sort of the way the sport's been, the high velocity, and then on the batting end of things, it's the launch angles and it's the, hey, let's try to smash the ball out of the park. I'm surprised that no one has tried to zag. I'm surprised that everyone seems to be going with the exact same approach baseball-wise, and I would like to see, and that's what I'm hoping to hear from Jerry DePoto. I want to hear something different. I'm sorry. You look at all the approaches. If every single approach is the same, if launch angle and power and velocity is all that matters, then, I mean, there's a huge untapped numerous areas where some teams should be theoretically able to take advantage by doing things differently.
How would that happen?
I think going back to just having guys who are just slapping hitters. I mean, that's the easy one.
See, that's the part where I think you're right about the approach, that you don't want to do the same things that other people are doing, because you can either work harder or work different, right? If you're gonna do the same thing that everybody else, you have to be so much better and so much smarter and work so much harder, or you can do it different than them. I don't think contact hitting is the way to go, because the way the game is, we'll see how the ball plays this year, but the way the game is right now, they've worked out a math solution, which is you can take exceptionally high strikeout numbers that before would have been huge outliers, and they're offset. If you hit enough home runs, it doesn't matter, because you're going to get more. It's a math problem, and how do you produce the most runs? Home runs produce.
Yeah.
Like that's a home run is better than four singles.
I agree, but I also go back to, you know, just the way the things were in the 90s and stuff. You work a pitcher's pitch count,
And that's by more at-bats and by prolonged at-bats and by taking pitches and by trying to put the ball in play. And there are a lot of these teams that just are whiffing and whiffing and whiffing some more. And what's it ultimately getting them? It's just giving the teams that they're going up against an easier outing, I think, on the mound.
Well, but the home runs, because that's what I would say, that approach has proven to score more runs. Like even with the high number of strikeouts, that approach does net more runs. So that's why guys aren't doing that because they're dumb. Guys aren't fixating on launch angle because it's a fad. It's because it's been proven out that emphasizing extra base hits and settling for an opposite field single, even if that means that your batting average is 40 points higher, well, if you're sacrificing 15 home runs based on the approach that you're taking, it's not worth it because you're going to produce more runs as a slugger than you are as someone who is a conventional. I wonder what would happen in Wade Boggs in today's game. Wade Boggs is one of the best hitters in the game.
Tony Gwynn,
when
too,
I was
yeah.
growing up. Gwynn had a little bit more pop. Boggs was someone who, especially early in his career, had almost no power. And how people would have, how he would be seen in today's game, and if he would have made it. Would he have been able to play a corner infield position, given the way
Without
he hits
power?
Right now? Probably not, because Kyle Seager's a guy who adopted and changed his game because he knew to play a corner infield position, he needed to have more power.
And that's one of the big questions about Evan White, because we know he can field, but is he going to be able to smack dingers? And that's something that we're going to have to wait and see. I think there's some skepticism about that at this point.
He's shown, and it's been interesting, because you're right, because he came, when they drafted him, was seen as someone with a plus glove, and that was going to be the asset, and has hit better than people expected. It is Danny and Gallant. We are here in Peoria, thanks to Alaska Airlines for sponsoring our spring training coverage with daily flights to Phoenix and Tucson. If you want to come down here and see some of the Cactus League, we've got Brock Huer joining us for Blue 42, and then we've got Jerry DePoto with us at 820. It's all ahead here from Peoria.